There's no question that dealing with children over religious matters can be a pretty formidable thing. I don't know how many of you have looked at this book, Children's Letters to God, published some years ago, compiled by Eric Marshall and Stuart Hample. It's a collection of quite genuine letters written by children exactly as they wrote them, with their misspellings and everything. And they're entertaining, but also very revealing. There's this prayer, for instance, from Bruce. Dear God, please send me a pony. I never asked for anything before. You can look it up. Or this inquiry from Harriet Ann. Dear God, are you real? Some people don't believe it. If you are, you better do something quick. There's an infant feminist in the making in Sylvia. Dear God, are boys better than girls? I know you are one, but try to be fair. And Barry is going to be a member of the music group when he grows up. Church is all right, but you could sure use better music. I hope this doesn't hurt your feelings. Sometimes, too, you come across infantile Pharisaism. Dear God, we've got a lot of religion in our house, so don't worry about us, Teddy. I suppose it's because children can be so disarming in their religious ideas and comments that quite a lot of parents fight shy talking about religion in the home. Sometimes I think this is because of a kind of general embarrassment we feel about religion. It's a private matter, we say. Not unlike sex, I suppose. Something that, you know, you don't talk about in company. Something you find a little bit embarrassing. Brings a blush to your cheeks. Sometimes, too, this reluctance on the part of parents, I think, is just a general feeling of inadequacy. These questions and comments that children make can have a surprising depth and can be very difficult to handle. Surely it's better to leave answering questions like that to the experts, to the professionals, to the church minister or the RE teacher at school. But I think far more generally these days, and far more importantly, there's a whole sphere of conscientious reservation about the issue in many parents' hearts. Many parents, I think, are worried that in some way teaching religion to their children is exploitative. They're afraid, perhaps, of indoctrination. Theorists actually have a lot of difficulty in defining exactly what they mean by indoctrination. Some people think it has something to do with educational method. Indoctrination involves psychological manipulation and the suppression of contrary evidence and the discouraging discussion and things like that. But these days, increasingly, there's a feeling, I think, that indoctrination also can be simply a matter of the content of what you're trying to pass on. It means the communication of questionable philosophical propositions as if they were an established truth. Not encouraging people to doubt is indoctrination. Indeed, in some circles, this fear of indoctrination goes so far as to fight shy of anything that you could call directive in education. Telling your children the truth is just out. I don't think it's difficult to trace the origin of this in sort of educational thinking. For many centuries, education was dominated by a view that I suppose began with Plato in ancient Greece. He took the view that you educated a child to be a good citizen. That was the purpose of education, to so mould the child that it fitted into society. It was a society-centred view of education. And that view held sway for many hundreds of years. It wasn't really until the 18th century, I suppose, that the philosopher Rousseau was a seminal thinker here, that people began to think, no, we shouldn't be state-centred, we shouldn't be society-centred. Society is what spoils children. We should be child-centred. The idea grew that every child is not a lump of amorphous clay to be moulded by education into a socially useful shape, but rather is a tiny seedling to be nurtured until it reaches its own individual flower. Society, therefore, mustn't impose its cramping stereotype on the developing child. It's not difficult to see how religious education can be seen as an offence against that doctrine. There's been, as I'm sure those of you who are in education know, a rejection of authoritarian teaching across the board. in the last few decades, in favour of what's sometimes called discovery learning. Children should be taught not that such and such is the case in a bald sort of rote way, but should be a non-directive approach should be used so as to lead them to make that discovery for themselves. And even such unquestionable truths as 2 plus 2 equals 4 are taught in that kind of discovery way these days, by techniques that help the child to find out rather than to be told. So a fear of indoctrination is something that's very deep in our modern culture. And I think associated with it is the related fear that maybe in religious education we may also be breeding intolerance in children. We live these days in a pluralistic society. Many different religions coexist. A strong trend of thought within the liberal democratic tradition that we've inherited is that religion, because history has proven it to be potentially divisive, should be kept as a matter of private conscience and not brought into the arena of public education at all. Shouldn't be taught in schools. And some parents, influenced by that, fight shy, I think, of introducing it into the home for fear that they are going to encourage their child to be a fanatic or a bigot. They look perhaps at Northern Ireland and suggest that such religious education, directed religious education, has contributed to the intractable nature of the problems there. And all these inhibitions regarding teaching children to believe, teaching children to share religious experience, I think is given further support in the last 20 or 30 years by educationalists who've tried to apply the theories of a man called Piaget to religious education. Piaget was a psychologist who was very interested in understanding the development of a child's mind, the development of its thinking ability. And I think very rightly he observed that children pass through phases in their ability to think. When they're very small, in infancy, they think largely in intuitive and non-verbalized ways. Then in their middle years, at what we call, might call primary school age, I suppose, they think in terms of words. They associate words with things, but it's still very concrete, the way in which they think. And it's not, he says, until they reach adolescence that children are actually capable of thinking in abstract, conceptual ways. I think possibly there's a great deal of truth in that. Certainly Piaget furnishes his papers and his books with a great deal of very convincing evidence of a child's psychological development. But you see, religious educators, particularly a man called Goldman, whom some of you may have read if you did your education theory back in the 60s, some people developing that Piaget tradition in religious education say, well, since religion is by definition a whole mass of abstract concepts, children are not ready for it until they reach adolescence. So you shouldn't try and communicate religious ideas to children below that age. It's just pointless. They're not learning ready for it. The best you can do, Goldman said, was to teach life themes. Things like homes, friends, seeds, birthdays, holidays, giving, themes like that, which he would say have a kind of a religious aspect to them. But only that kind of concrete theme can a child relate to. Anything in the nature of theology or doctrine is quite literally incomprehensible to a child in its younger years. Now, all these, I think, all these problems, the fear of indoctrination, the fear of intolerance, the awareness that a child cannot handle abstract ideas when it's very young, all these things I think are very real and justified and have profound elements of truth in them, things that I've had to think about very seriously in the bringing up of my own child or children. But I'd like to suggest to you tonight that they don't constitute an unanswerable position, that there are good reasons for teaching children religion, and I want to give you three, which mean a lot to me and seem to have been important in my own experience of bringing up my children. I'll start with this one. There are important questions children ask which cannot be adequately answered without reference to religious convictions. And I'll mention two of these issues in particular. Death and right and wrong. It's highly probable that at some point in every child's early life, they will experience death. Hopefully, it will only be the death of a favourite pet. But it could quite likely be the death of a family relative, a grandparent, for instance. And in certain tragic cases, of course, it can be the death of a parent or a brother or sister. Children pass through a phase, too, of fearing death. In my own children, that's quite often happened around the age of 6 or 7. They've started asking questions about dying and what it exactly means. They need reassurance. Now, it seems to me extremely desirable that parents should be able to prepare children for the phenomena of death in the family and answer those fears when they emerge in the child's mind. And I am completely lost to know how parents who want to talk to their children about death are to do so without bringing some kind of religious category, religious aspect into the matter. I was brought up in the East End of London, and I still remember to this day playing with some older children at school at funerals. A learned 9-year-old in our gang had recently had his grandmother die in the home, and he had studied the whole business of funerals in great detail. And he led us in a macabre but highly educational reconstruction of the event. A coffin was duly prepared out of a shoebox, with a doll wrapped in a rather dirty handkerchief for a shroud. A grave was dug, and there in solemn procession we carried the coffin for interment, echoing the words which he'd heard the day before on the minister's lips at the funeral. Our leader said in broad Cockney, "In the name of the Father and the Son and in the Holy Ghost." And for years, that's what I believed the funeral formula was. See, those of you with a Christian education don't realize what you've missed. My point in telling the story is that our children will learn about death and its religious implications, either from us, or in the garbled and confused way that children learn from other children. We can't avoid that subject. But I ask you, how can you talk to a child about death without introducing the subject of religion? It's a brave atheist who can tell his 6-year-old, "Oh, when you die, you rot, son." The other area of important questions which children ask about and which cannot be adequately answered without reference to religious convictions is, in my view, an even bigger and more important one. It's the whole question of right and wrong. Now, obviously, there's a great deal of wisdom in this trend towards discovery learning in the place of authoritarian teaching. Education can be, without any question, a very vicious instrument of social manipulation. But I do think the pendulum has swung rather too far if we adopt a totally non-directive approach when it comes to areas of moral values. See, whether we like it or not, we are moulding our children's character and personality. Rousseau was quite wrong to think that a child is born with a ready-made personality in the bud, which will flower into its own unique individuality if you just leave it alone. It isn't the way it is at all. What a child is born with is a pool of genetic potentials, out of which its character and personality is selected as a result of cultural education, cultural conditioning, if you like. A child left without social influences of any kind, in fact, grows up not to be an ideal picture of innocence, but a demented vegetable. And there have been some very sad incidents recorded in the literature of such children who have grown up without being taught, without being encultured by their environment, by their parents, by their family, and so on, who've proven that. So you see, when we argue for a non-directive approach to education, as it's fashionable to do, we cannot claim to be removing all influence on the growth of our child's personality and character. We are just putting a different influence on the child's personality and character. And in its own way, such an influence can be as destructive as the old Victorian authoritarian influence used to be. Because when you come to areas of right and wrong, what does discovery learning imply? It implies that we human beings are competent to define our own moral values. That's what it implies. It implies, if you want to find out what's right and wrong when it comes to sex, experiment. Discover. Find out for yourself. Now, that may very well be the permissive creed of many adults in our 20th century world, but I have very profound doubts about whether all of us here would feel secure in passing it on to our children. Plato and Rousseau are not at opposite ends of the educational spectrum in the way that people sometimes make out. It's not true that Plato was educating for the state and Rousseau was educating for the individual. The truth is that Plato and Rousseau had different views of human society, and both of them were educating with a view to that kind of society they wanted. In Plato's case, it was a very disciplined, well-ordered society. In Rousseau, it was a revolutionary and anarchistic society. But however you do it, whether you use directive education or non-directive education, you're influencing your child, you're bringing them up to function in a particular social milieu. If morality is to be taught, if our children are to gain any sense of right and wrong, it seems to me there has to be imparted to them some concept of moral authority. I don't see how you can have any idea of right and wrong without giving the word ought a meaning. And the whole point about the word ought is that if it's going to be meaningful, it has to come down from above. You have to receive some kind of authority behind it. When a teenage child is told to do something, what do they ask? Who says? We can't use the word ought unless that question has some kind of answer. Now, of course, in infancy, parental authority is often enough. Because I say so, says Dad. Unless we want our children to grow up with the idea that Dad is the ultimate authority in the universe, an idea which he will discard when he becomes a teenager, then we need to teach our children that there is more to it than that. The reason Dad says so is because there is an authority even behind Dad that sustains the moral judgment, the moral values of the universe. Dad doesn't say so out of arbitrary whim, but because he has his own moral standards defined. Who by? It's a religious question. Bernard Shaw, bless him, in his book Misalliance, in his preface to Misalliance, writes like this. Children must be taught some sort of religion. He says, odd to think of that coming from the lips of Bernard Shaw, isn't it? Children must be taught some sort of religion. Secular education is an impossibility, he says. Secular education comes to this, that the only reason for ceasing to do evil and learning to do well is that if you don't, you will be caned. Well, he puts it in his usual blunt way, but I think there's a case there for the secularists to answer. Doesn't it come down to that, ultimately? And once we've dispensed with the cane, have we not also dispensed with any thought that we can teach right and wrong to children in such a world? Well, you may like to discuss this further over coffee, but it certainly seems to me that in these two areas at least, and there are probably many others, death and right and wrong, it is very difficult to teach our children in a healthy and an honest way without invoking religious categories. And I think if you don't believe it, you better try it. Let me give a second reason why I think teaching our children religion is something we've just got to take on board, no matter how difficult it is. It isn't possible to educate our children without imparting some kind of religious or philosophical worldview. The psychologist Skinner has a famous quote where he says, "Education is what remains when you've forgotten everything you ever learned." Think about that, that's quite an interesting point of view. Education's what remains when you've forgotten everything you ever learned. But the trouble, it seems to me, with a great deal of modern Western education is that once you've forgotten what you learned, you're left with nothing. I mean, the curriculum is like a clothesline. This is a picture I often use. And you hang on the clothesline a whole range of clothes. Maths, English, French, physics, chemistry, geography, history. But very little is done, even in our modern national curriculum, it seems to me, to integrate these studies so that the child develops some kind of general understanding of the world. Plenty of clothes, but little attention paid to the clothesline. Indeed, because of its suspicion about religion, secular education usually just hangs RE as another item of clothing on the line. Where, in fact, of course, what RE is meant to be is the clothesline. The worldview which integrates everything we learn. Without that line, the child learns piecemeal. It goes to the chemistry lesson and finds man is a product of organic reactions. Goes to the biology lesson and finds man is a product of animal evolution. Goes to the geography lesson and learns that man is a product of cultural conditioning. Goes to the history lesson and finds man is a product of economic determination. Goes to the English lesson and finds that, in the opinion of a large number of 20th century authors, man is a product of nothing at all. What kind of use is that to a child who wants to ask, well, who am I then? And that's a big question. Could say that's the fundamental question. If we aren't helping our children to find a sense of identity, who they are, then what on earth are we teaching them? What does education mean? In fact, it's no surprise, is it, that that kind of secular education breeds skepticism. It has to. Because no foundation for faith is being laid there. All you're being taught is that, well, you can make up your mind to believe what you want because all sorts of people have different kind of opinions about things. The whole atmosphere is one of skepticism, of doubt, of lack of commitment. It's almost educated to be uncommitted intellectually in our secular world. Now, I say I find that most unacceptable because it's illusory. Secularists may make out that they are teaching some kind of value-free education. But that's what they're imparting, unlike we Christians or the Muslims or whoever else they may pick on, who load their education with indoctrination. They are simply letting the child, quote, make up its own mind about things. But you see, that isn't true. They're teaching skepticism. They're imparting their own secularist, uncommitted perspective, their own agnosticism, to a new generation. They're making a lack of commitment admirable. They're providing no clothesline around which a growing child can integrate its own sense of identity. And that's just as much a worldview, you see. That secularist, skeptical, agnostic position is just as much a worldview as the Christian one is. It's just as much a faith commitment as the Christian one is. It rests on philosophical presuppositions just as much as the Christian one did. It's an illusion to think that you can ever educate without communicating either actively or by default a view of the world to the child you're teaching. It comes across whether you intended to or not. Education is what remains when you've forgotten everything you learned. It's the clothesline that's still there when the clothes have fallen off. When all that swatting you did for GCE or GCSE as it is now has drifted away and you can't remember your French verbs or your logarithms or your three times table, what remains is the view you have of the world and of yourself and of your place in it, your understanding of why you're here and where you're going, what human existence means. And it's impossible to educate without imparting that, which is a religious issue. That's why, of course, Solomon, the great wise man of the Old Testament, said, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." The way Christians think about education, faith is a presupposition of knowledge. It isn't that we understand things and then we decide we're going to believe. It's much more that we believe and our faith helps us to understand. By faith, we understand. That's the way the Bible puts it. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, the foundation of it. It's impossible to educate without imparting some kind of religious or philosophical worldview. So if we've got to do it, if it's inevitable, then we ought to pay attention to what that worldview is. That's my second reason, then, for being positive about religious education. And the third view, argument is this, third reason is this. Not to introduce children to religious ideas is to deny them the opportunity of religious experience. Here I come to that passage that we did read earlier from the Gospel of Matthew when we were thinking about the dedication of Oliver and Thomas. Let the children come to me and do not hinder them, Jesus said. It's quite clear then that Jesus believed, whatever child psychologists might say, that children are capable of genuine religious experience. Their infancy doesn't shut them off from him, make them him inaccessible to them. He doesn't say, wait until you're grown up, then you can come and learn from me. Let the children come to me, he says. The disciples were of our modern child psychological point of view. Well, they would better wait until they're a bit older. Jesus rebukes them. Let them come, he says, and don't hinder them. And that doesn't mean, of course, that Goldman and Piaget and the others are wrong when they say that young children cannot understand abstract concepts. They're absolutely right about that. But when they say that because children cannot understand abstract concepts, they ought not to be introduced to Christianity, they're making a blunder. They're exposing the fact that they have no real understanding of what real Christianity is. But the whole point is, you see, that real Christianity is not a framework of abstract concepts. Oh, there's such a thing as theology, I don't doubt that. And I think it's jolly useful for those of us of adult years to read some theology and understand it. But theology is not the essence of what Christianity is. And if you're here tonight thinking it is, then perhaps this is the most important lesson you can learn tonight. Christianity is about an experience of personal relationship with God through Christ. And the fundamental components of that relationship do not lie in abstract concepts, but in heart experiences. Experiences like love, forgiveness, acceptance, security, hope. Those experiences are the emotional vocabulary out of which religious experience, or at least Christian religious experience, is constructed. And those experiences are added to a child's emotional vocabulary at an enormously young age. A very tiny child has some experience of love and forgiveness and acceptance and security and hope. At least, if it's raised in a normal and healthy family, it does. All then that is required in opening a child up to religious experience in the Christian sense is that that child should have its horizon broadened beyond the immediate confines of the family to perceive that these experiences that they have learned from their parents of love and forgiveness and acceptance and security and hope, that these experiences have a much bigger context in a relationship they can have with an unseen parent, one who quite deliberately calls himself father. Of course, a child will have rather simple concepts of God. Of course, when you go and ask them to write a letter to God, they'll come out with some pretty crackpot ideas, as that book I began by reading shows. But I have a suspicion God is not so offended by naive ideas about him as some theologians and religious educationalists are. I suspect when God looks at us, he finds all our notions of him rather naive. Remember what Paul said about when I was a child, he said, I thought like a child, I spoke like a child. When I became a man, I put away childish things. What he's meaning there when he says that famous line is that when God looks down at us, our babblings, our theology, our sermons, our prophecies, our teaching, all looks like the babbling of a child, the reasoning of a child. And when we get to heaven, when the perfect comes, and we look back on the things we said about God down here, we shall be embarrassed by just how infantile it seems, because we shall see it that way then too. Now, God is not so offended, as we think, by naive, anthropomorphic, even erroneous ideas about him. He's not so offended about them as we sometimes think. What he is interested in is a personal relationship with his creatures. And Jesus assures us in that passage when he says, let the children come to me and don't hinder them, that it's possible for an experience of that personal relationship with God to begin at a very, very young age. Samuel illustrates it too, doesn't it? Samuel, who we read about in that reading in 1 Samuel 3. God had no difficulty in talking to Samuel, child though he was. And Samuel had no difficulty in responding, child as he was. He wasn't handicapped by his psychological immaturity, because it wasn't a theological notion of God that was being communicated, was it? It was a relationship. Samuel, here I am. Your servant is listening. Here we are then, three reasons, important reasons it seems to me, why we shouldn't deny our children religious education. And I'm speaking here always primarily about religious education in the home. First, there are important questions which children ask that can't be adequately answered without reference to religious convictions. If we want our children to find their way through life, then we better be prepared to give some directive education. Secondly, it's not possible to educate without imparting some kind of religious or philosophical worldview. They will pick up an understanding of themselves and of the universe whether we positively try to teach them a Christian viewpoint or not. If we are concerned then that their minds should be truly open rather than subliminally brainwashed by a secularist world, we'd better make sure there is definite Christian input into their minds. And thirdly, not to introduce children to religious ideas is to deny them the importance, deny them the opportunity of religious experience. Denying them a variety, I suggest perhaps, even of spiritual experience that can never be recovered once childhood is over, and that may impoverish them, perhaps even for a lifetime. Do you recall what Jesus said about those who cause these little ones who believe in me to stumble? Better a millstone round their neck and cast in the depths of the sea, he said. Well, how do we do it? What's the method which we who are parents must use if we are to teach our children the Christian religion? In a way which does not indoctrinate, which doesn't fall victim to all the dangers which we're so painfully aware of in our generation that may come from a religious education. How are we to do it? Just as I close, maybe I can just give you four brief pointers that I find useful. The first thing I want to say is negative. I'm personally not terribly enthusiastic about catechizing children. Now, there may be some of you here from a Presbyterian tradition, grown up with the Shorter Catechism, who were taught the Catechism as a child, and who will feel rather offended by my saying that. And I'm sorry if that's so, but I must confess, my own conscience is clear on the matter, I am worried about the catechizing of children. Because, you see, what the Catechism is a list of questions, theological questions, with right answers that you learn by rote. Now, I know it's possible to teach it in a more informed and wise way than that, but basically, that's what it is. It's a mini systematic theology taught by a question and answer technique intended for children. But you see, I have no doubt that children can learn the catechism and can give the right answer, but I have profound doubts about whether it helps them in their religious experience at all. In many cases, I think, the amount of actual understanding of what they're saying has to be very limited, precisely for Goldman's reasons, that children's conceptual ability develops quite slowly, and handling the big ideas which the Shorter Catechism has within it is far beyond the reach of a child under teenage years, it seems to me. But more than that, subtly teaching the Catechism imparts to the child the idea that religion consists in knowing the right answers to theological questions. And it doesn't. Religion consists in personally knowing God. Even if our children's theology is hopelessly ill-informed and if they can't verbalize it anyway that would satisfy a professional theologian, there's no matter. The most important thing is that God should be a real person to them. That's what we seek to communicate. And we can actually blind them to that, give them a false view of what religion is by teaching them a catechetical kind of approach to it. Remember what Jesus said, let the children come to me. It's a personal relationship he wanted to establish with these children. The second thing I'd like to say, I think it's very important that both parents play a role, if at all possible, in relating to a children on religious matters. Now, I say that because I have discovered that in an awful lot of homes, teaching the child religion, doing whatever you do with your children to try and encourage them in religious matters, is left to the mother. In fact, I've come across quite a few mums who have suddenly discovered an interest for the first time in Christianity because they've felt the need to talk to their children at bedtime about the things that the child is asking and have suddenly realized this child is asking questions that need religious answers. But there seems to be something in our culture which makes dads fight shy of getting involved in that sort of thing. In fact, I do wonder if the whole thought that religion is somehow effeminate is tied up with the fact that from childhood, men have grown up to think that it is mothers who talk about religious matters, not fathers. Now, I'd urge you, if at all possible, for both parents to be involved in talking to the child about Christian things. The third thing I'll say is this. I believe one of the most important things we can do is just to tell Bible stories. Now, the reason for that is quite simple. All of us know that from a very early age, from the first time that we can really understand as children, we enjoy hearing stories. Why? Well, because stories are a way of expanding our horizon, expanding our circle of experience vicariously. A child can't experience everything firsthand. None of us can. But our understanding expands as we learn to extrapolate from the emotional experiences we've had within the family to a wider circle. And storytelling is the most important way of doing that. Now, why is so much of the Bible narrative? Why is so much of the Bible story rather than theology? Well, I suggest to you it's because in the wisdom of God, he knows that this is the way in which we expand our religious experience too. By entering into the experience of others. By hearing stories and extrapolating from our own limited emotional experience out into the experience of those men and women of God who knew him personally. And by entering into their experience, by identifying with them, we begin to learn what it might feel like to know God for ourselves. And maybe even to begin hesitantly to try to do that. Storytelling is, I think, one of the most important positive ways in which we can communicate to our children what real religious experience is about. And it's infinitely superior to teaching the catechism, in my view. And the fourth thing I want to say really hinges on that. Perhaps the most important thing we can do with our children is to pray with them. Precisely because prayer is the way in which we express our personal relationship to God. A child who grows up knowing that it's quite possible to talk to God in an ordinary way, in an intimate way, as a child to a parent, a child who grows up with that consciousness buried deep within it, is always going to know that at heart, knowing God is about knowing him personally. It's not about reading books, answering questions, putting your hand up and having the right answer. It's about being able to relate to an unseen God in a personal and real and living way. Nothing perhaps communicates that to the child more effectively than prayer. Well, let's pray together briefly before we sing our final hymn.